Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
We'll be right back.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't, lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he...
All right. And if you want to step into the world of the super bourgeoisie, one of the ways that you can do it, that's my opinion, is to start a family business. So today's podcast, we're developing this idea on as well as offline, production societies. When I play the that long audio, Factory City, which is from the documentary Factory City, free on, YouTube, but I have a digital copy. Same thing, exact same film, but I bought the digital copy because it's got some powerful examples that anybody can model. You have to build up to that level, but still. So, yeah, production societies, family GNC. What's your family's gross national product? Now, I believe if we can get like some of these high crime, all right, for instance, if you take a neighborhood, it can be any socioeconomic, let's say some of your lower socioeconomic neighborhoods and families that live within those neighborhoods. And this is why yesterday I played quite a bit of Mignon Francois, for those who caught yesterday's podcast or live stream. For those who didn't, I'll explain her in a moment or two. But this woman, well, I'll explain it now, because it ties into production societies, you know, family GMPs, the family gross national product. These are words that need to be, in terms that need to be discussed around the breakfast table with the kids, even if they can't talk yet. And the question of the day is, what is your family business? What is your family business? So we're going to come back to that. What is your family business? You know, what's your family's GMP? But you know what? I don't even need to know the figure. Just, is there a family GMP? Now, you can't count. This is a qualified question. You can't count retirement. You can't count income coming in from a job. That answer is based on what kind of revenue is generated from your family business. And in order to do that, what does your family make? We'll be back in 3 minutes.
I was talking to a cat the other night. They weren't everybody looking for this, but everybody's looking for today. They're looking for escapism. Look at him.
said, Fred?
Man, you know you better take it on the lamb.
You better watch the man.
I don't like the hood. What you said, Fred?
I said we better take it on the lamb out of here.
Huh. You better watch the man.
But
come over here, brother. Let me tell you something. You think we're talking too loud?
Hush that butt.
I ain't got no dust.
I don't have to take it on the land.
Watch that man.
Huh?
Watch that man.
Watch him. Yeah, all right. You're right. Yeah. Coming from some funny places. What'd you say, bro?
What's happening, bro?
Huh. Trying to get down.
Yeah.
Well, you know, look at him. We can't have that.
That's right. Right on. Yeah.
Ain't no alcohol. Man, I don't dig it. What you say, J-Ton?
Hey, don't be so mean.
You know I'm clean now.
All right, that was the hardest working man in show business, James Brown. And, all right, he had a checkered background, particularly when it came to domestic violence. But, you know, we're going to move past all that for this podcast. James Brown, he had, his family had a GMP while he was living. I don't know how it's going now. Because he's been gone for some years now, but James Brown had a let's go to Wikipedia. He had multiple businesses. He used to own WEBB in Baltimore, Maryland. Let's see, James Brown business. Okay, he owned at least one radio station. He owned, let me get it from the street here. I think he owned a record label as well, King Records. I bought my share of James Brown Records. I wish they would list, now I'm on Wikipedia. And I mean, they've got his personal life, social activism, artistry. I wish they would list his business career. Man, because people like him, it's interesting, people like him and Ike Turner. Ike Turner had a business career within, and Chuck Berry too. These guys were business innovators within their niche, within their industry. But, you know, they don't, you know what, they has to become we. We need to, that's what I'm doing here this morning. Okay, let's see. James Brown, I know he owned a radio station. He had a record press company. All right, Mr. Dynamite. No, I'm trying to get into it. You know, I'm sure it's online. But the man really, he was a phenomenal businessman. All right, here's a little bit something. Okay. All right, in November, I'm trying to. Let me go. I might have found something here. All right, well, let me read from where. All right. In addition to his touring of singles and studio albums, Brown output during this period included two more successful live albums, Live at the Garden, 1967, Live at the Apollo, Volume 2, 1968, and a 1968 special, James Brown, Man to Man. His music empire expanded along with his influence in the music scene. As Brown's music empire grew, his desire for financial and artistic independence grew as well. Brown bought radio stations, so he had more than WEBB. during the late 1960s, including WRDW and his native Augusta, Georgia, where he shined shoes as a boy. In November 1967, James Brown purchased radio stations WGYW in Knoxville, Tennessee, for a reported $75,000. According to January 20, 1968, Record World magazine, the callers would change to WJBE, reflecting his initials. WJBE began on January 15, 1968, and broadcast rhythm and blues format. The station slogan was WJBE, 1430 Raw Soul. Brown also bought WEBB in Baltimore, Maryland in 1970. All right, so he owned multiple radio stations. See, that's all part of the, you know, the family GMP. Brown branched into several musical, several recordings with musicians, all right, in his band, all right. Oh, you know what? Let's put that out there, though, because he had two bands, which both made money for the individual band. He had Maceo and the Max. That was one of his bands, and Fred Wesley and the Horny Horns. And I believe Fred Wesley is still alive and performing, and I believe so is Maceo Parker. But that was all part of it. All right. In an attempt to appeal to older, more affluent, predominantly white adult contemporary audiences, Brown recorded Getting Down to It in 1969 and Soul on Top. Didn't know that. Two albums consisted mostly of romantic ballads, jazz standards, and homogenous interpretations of his earlier hits with Dee Felice, the Dee Felice Trio, and Louis Belson Orchestra. In 1968, he recorded a number of funk-oriented tracks, okay, with Daps, a white Cincinnati band, including the hit I Can't Stand Myself. He also released three Christmas albums. All right, well, the man had a supply chain. He wrote music. He published music. He had a record press. I mean, the supply chain. He had the record press. He had two bands to tour his music, and he had radio stations to play the music and generate advertising funds for that as well. So, James Brown family. Well, that's just some of James Brown's family business. He produced records. He made records. He pressed records. Although James Brown had multiple baby mamas, he had a place for his children to work. Now, I understand there was some legal wranglings after he passed away. I don't know if that's been resolved. But we'll cover him more in depth one day, because James Brown is a topic. The business side of James Brown. I'm not getting into the stories of him beating up Tammy Terrell and all that. All that's documented too. But what I like about James Brown is the man was a businessman. Okay, when I'm not getting into a moral debate on him. Okay, I'm just. Let's take a look at James Brown, a black man with a limited formal education, but with a superior business education, primarily self-taught. He didn't go to college or community college he learned by trial and error. And I'm sure he had some mentors along the way. So that's the angle that we're going to get into when it comes to James Brown and family GMPs, family gross national. I mean, yeah, the gross national product. So we can with James Brown, we can see just on a surface level that he had a family business. And now I don't know how involved that was. Let me go to something a little bit easier. Dr. Frederick K.C. Price, who's transitioned to earlier this year, either earlier this year or late last year. But his business, I guess you can call it the gospel. Fred Price, the late Fred Price, his family with Crenshaw Christian Center, his primary nuclear family are all employed through Crenshaw Christian Center, and he's gone. Fred's gone physically, or his energy form has changed. But Fred's gone, but the family business still runs. Now, Fred Price, if you know his story, Fred Price struggled for years. He was broke, man. He had a family. He was broke. Even when he started his church, he was broke. He was struggling with that church for like 10, 12, 14 years. Then things started to turn around for him. But let me bring you up to 2022. Fred, now, although Fred's gone, he's still running it from the grave. His eldest living child, because he had a son that died. I don't know if that son, his first son was the oldest child, but it was the firstborn son. But he died in a car accident. But his eldest child, Angela, I believe her name is Angela Evans. Angela Evans, Fred Price's oldest child, of him and Betty Price. I believe Betty Price is still living. She's still living. But she runs Crenshaw Christian Center. That whole thing with the Faith Dome, the whole, you know, the broadcast, the daily operations, the ministries and all that, she runs it. All in the family. She raised up in the business. And then he's got, he's got two other daughters. One daughter, it's the second daughter. I forgot her name. The second daughter, Cheryl, that's her name. Because I saw when he came to D.C. once, when he took ever-increasing faith on the road, they came to D.C. a couple years in a row, and I went to see them both years. But Cheryl, I saw her up close. But all of his children, making this long story short, all of his children are in the family business, every last one of them. Now, Fred, they sell books that he wrote. And I'm sure before he passed, him and his son probably co-authored something. But Betty Price, they got books that they sell that she wrote. They do conventions and seminars. That's all part of their family, Crenshaw Christian Center brand. That's part of their brand. They go out and they produce their own conferences. They have their own books. All right. Like I say, all of us, he's got like three daughters. All three of them work in the family business. Now, all of their spouses, except for maybe Cheryl, that's the second eldest daughter, when she was married, her husband, matter of fact, when I saw her in Washington, D.C., she was married. And her husband at that time, he worked for ever-increasing faith. Now, and I was following Fred Press before they got the Faith Dome. All right. So they also have a school. You know, so they're in the education business, too. So that's all part of the family business. Let me go online and look up, Crenshaw. Crenshaw Christian. Here we go. Crenshaw Christian Center. And I'm sure it's the same with Creflo Dollar. I'm sure it's the same with T.D. Jakes and a number of other people. But you, and I'm only picking these people out. You don't have to start a church to have a family-based business. Okay. It can be anything. You can be growing food and set up a family business or a chain of farmers markets to sell your produce. All right. You know what? My grandmother really could have set up something like that. She had six daughters and a son. I don't know about the son, but she taught all of her daughters and probably the son too, my uncle, how to sew. That really could have been a family business if they were thinking that way. But all of her daughters knew how to make clothes by sight. They can look at any article of clothing that you're wearing on you, made out of any type of material, and replicate it. They even knew how to make their own patterns out of newspapers. Anyway, but and I'm sitting here, I'm looking at three of the, my mother left behind, let's see, one, two, three, four, five sewing machines. I'm looking at three of them right now. I need to teach myself how to sew. But in any event, all right, I'm on Crenshaw Christian Center's website, and under that umbrella, all right, they have a store on here, the church, the leaders. I haven't been on here in a while. But within it, because I was looking for their ministries. All right, his youngest child, Frederick K.C. Price Jr., his wife, Fred Price's daughter-in-law, she's on there. They still have a picture of Fred on there, Betty Price, his wife. I want to look at their what kind of ministries they have. But like I said, you don't have to be in a religious, but anything. If you're good at fishing, or that's why my favorite story to tell of late is Mignon Francois. You know, her family business is making cupcakes. Now, they got cakes in there, too, but, I mean, her bread and butter, the family's bread and butter, are cupcakes. You know what? They haven't called me back. I called yesterday. I'm going to call again today. Let me double-check my messages here. Yeah, because I called Mignon Francois' office, yes, so I'm going to call him again today. I'll call him again today. But and I got the email address, too. I'll call and email today. Yesterday I just called. Today I'm going to call again. And if I get the voicemail like I did, I'm going to leave my information as I did yesterday. But I'm going to email today. So... working on that. So, in any event, let me go for the program notes here on Blog Talk Radio. So, what does your family make? And my mother passed away like 3 years ago. So, in order to settle her estate, I gotta take this family business. It's just me and a chihuahua right now. Okay, I got a cousin on New Orleans. She helps with some stuff, with a lot of stuff actually. So. What does your family make? What's your family GMP? And once again, you cannot include a pension fund unless you have a family-based business, and the family business pension fund pays you. But if it's from a regular 9-to-5, that doesn't count. All right, so what's your family's DMP? The Amish and the Mennonite families, maybe not 100% of them, but well over 50% of them have a family-based business. Some, matter of fact, let me go online, and if you're welcome to go online with me. Let's see, Amish businesses. Just let me, well, I got a directory here. Okay. Amish America. All right. There's a website titled Amish America. Searching for an Amish business. And these are ideas that anybody can model, people. Searching for Amish business. The Amish Business Directory lists Amish companies and product retailers across North America. Find addresses and contact information for Amish stores, markets, construction firms, and other businesses and goods and with the links below. Okay. So let's click on furniture. All right. The Amish roofers. And these are basically family-based businesses. So let me set up a scenario here. Okay. Particularly when it comes to the topic of, in air quotes, white supremacy. Let's say you have a black person that went to a vocational school in the city. Could be Baltimore, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Seattle, whatever, pick a city. And they did pretty well, and they're good enough to, they can build a shed, they can build a carport, they can build a cabin, they can build a house. All right. So, now what's been drilled in that person's head is go to school. They did that. They went to vocational school. Get good grades. They did that in vocational school. And they got the physical skill set to build houses and carports and various things. All right. They can make furniture. They're good woodworkers. So, but he's got the mindset, go out and get a job. And that means simply go out to someone else out of your community, out of your household, because mom and dad, they work jobs for somebody else. They might even have good. You got to go out and find a job. But you got the skills, and you have the so-called good grades. So you go to, okay. Now, let me go back to my directory here. All right. You go to, you know what, let's say, let's go to Maryland. Okay. And you find the Shed King, S-H-E-D, the Shed King. And it's located in Charlotte Hall, Maryland. And you apply for a job, and you got some pictures of your work, of the nice, pristine sheds that you've built. But Shed King ain't hiring you. So you go to somebody else. And I'm on this. Let's say you go to Marcellus, Michigan, and you go to DeHart Development in Marcellus, Michigan. And, you know, They built various buildings, but you get turned down by them too. So then you go to, I'm on this directory, that's why I'm bouncing around state to state. You go to Missouri, Ozark, Missouri, and you go to, the name of the company is called All Amish Construction. And you show pictures of your work in it, and you get turned down by them too. Then you think about calling Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson. And then you thought, you, in the meantime, while you're looking, you get somebody pregnant, and you can't, you ain't got enough money to pay for the Pampers. Then you go into a state of mind, well, the white man's not hiring me. I got the skills, I done got the certifications, I got the proof of the certifications, but the white man's not hiring. Why? First thing, you're going to businesses that they could have been all black, but you're going to family-based businesses. So the smartest thing for you to do is to start your own family-based business. Because you already know how to make the sheds. Every company that you were going to for a job, okay, to practice your craft, you can do the same thing for yourself. And there's more money in profits than in wages. See, if you go to work for somebody, you're going to get paid a wage. It might be an hourly wage or a wage in the form of a salary. But there's more money if you have your own thing and you make profits over wages. Profits always outdistance wages. All right? But see, you weren't told that for those 12 years you went to school. So then, once you open up your own, you know, just like these people, because these are all family-based businesses, and then you can hire your own kids if you want to. But on this office directory, they got all phase. Every last one of these are family-based businesses. Every last one of them. Now, I clicked on the construction part, but they also have, let's see, let's go to, I don't see none in my state. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Okay. All right, you got Neil Miller Roofing, Emma Novi. I'm in Wisconsin. You got Neil Miller Roofing in Madovi, Wisconsin. I'm sure the person that answers the phone is related to Neil Miller. And I'm sure the person that gives the estimate, if it's not Neil Miller, it's a blood relative of Neil Miller. Okay. Tennessee. Yoder's Dutch Barns. Now, there's a city in Kansas called Yoder, Kansas. That's an all Amish and Mennonite community. Town. And matter of fact, you know, everything I'm reading off of, these are production societies. These are production societies. These societies are made up primarily of families. Okay. That say, you know what, let's get together and start a business. And some of them are to the point where they have their own towns. Yoder, Kansas is one of them. Now, black folks can do the same. And historically, the black townships that I talk about, though, when they first started, Those were production societies. They grew food and they sold it. And then as the Great Migration kicked in, you know, they stopped. Some of those towns are still around, some aren't. But in any event, here in I'm looking at a listing here in Tennessee, in Cumberland Furnace, Tennessee, Yoder Dutch Barns. Okay, well, we know that they built Dutch Barns. I'm sure if we call this number at Yoder Dutch Barns, whoever picks up the phone is related to Yoder. All right. If you ask, are there any openings? Okay. If you're not related to Yoder, your chances are slim to none of getting hired at Yoder Dutch Barns. Here's another one in New York State. In Tully, New York, Amish Structures. Okay, and now I'm asking the question to Amish Structures. What does your family make? Well, here it is on the website. All right, they have an extensive choice of log. They make log cabins. They make houses. They make vacationer houses. They make retreat houses. Let's see. They make outdoor structures, including sheds, gazebos, horse barn. Let's look at their profit centers now. Now, this is Amish Structures in Tully, New York. Okay, so the question is, what is the family bet? What does your family make? So here are the profit centers. They have profit centers in log cabins, profit centers in housing, vacationer, retreats, that's four. They make outdoor structures, five, including sheds, six, gazebo, seven, eight, horse barns, pavilions, nine, pagodas, 10. There's at least 10 profit centers, general profit centers, because they have niches within those, but they have at least 10 profit centers where they're making something in the Amish Structure, and that's the name of the business, the Amish Structures in Tully, New York. That family is a micro-production society. That family GMP is measured, not measured in paychecks, not measured in EBT cards, and I'm not knocking EBT cards. I'm not knocking Section 8. I'm just saying, here's some distinctions that, because the person with the EBT card, the person with Section 8, they can basically transition over to the same thing that these Amish businesses that I've been talking about this morning. Now, you might have to develop a skill set along the way. That's okay. That's why last week we were talking about, and that's why we'll be taking offline, the first 20 hours of building house building. You're not going to be a master home builder at the end of 20 hours. But you'll have enough of the fundamentals where you can self-correct along the way. Because everybody's got to go through the first 20 hours of anything. Mignon Francois, she had to do her 20 hours to learn the cupcake business. But in the learning process, which I've repeated before, all right, she took $5, bought the ingredients. Her daughters made that first batch of cupcakes. She sold for $60. It didn't take them 20 hours to do that. But that was the beginning of them learning the cupcake business. Because by the end of the week, that did the same thing over 10 more times or 9 more times and made $600 for the week. So this was their process of learning. God knows how much money they made within their first 20 hours. Matter of fact, to do the math. Okay, she made $60, all right, minus five for materials, $55 profit. All right, so, and in the first week, she did that 10 times. So, 55 times 10. All right. So we know she did at least 10 times. Now, here's the thing. All right. And let's say it took about, it took my week to get through the first 20 hours. Now, the big mission in her story at that time was her house was going to foreclosure. All right. I don't know how much she owed on that, but they did whatever they needed to do, to come up with whatever amount. That's why I want to get her on this show, on this podcast, so she can give us those details. I want you guys to hear from her, the family's first 20 hours, and then how many hours did they have to put in manufacturing cupcakes. So that's what they did. They manufactured cupcakes. Most people are not going to put it in those terms, but look up the word manufacture. They manufactured cupcakes. And they had to sustain the family, 7 kids, food, clothing, shelter, the whole 9. And they're about to be put out. That meant either being split up and going to live with the other family members if they could have done that. I don't know. Those are the details of her story that I want on this podcast. So I'll reach out again tomorrow. I mean today. Excuse me, not tomorrow. Today. I tried yesterday for the first time. Today I'll do it again. But her family is a production society. It's a family. But it's a family that has a product. They do cakes now. They do cupcakes as well as cakes. I don't know what else they do. But if you go to their website, the cupcake collection, it's on there. Matter of fact, you know what? Why put off? I'm going on there. Let's do it now because let's record all this. The cupcake collection. Okay. Let's go to their website. Okay, the cupcake collection. And, okay, cupcake orders. All right, they have two basic distinctions. They have cupcakes. They make cupcakes, and they make cakes. Then they have a location in Nashville. They got one in New Orleans. But I want to go through how many different, all right, I had to scroll down. They have textured cake, that's a profit center. They have ruffled cake, that's a profit center. They have traditional cake, that's a profit center. They have rosette cake, that's another profit center. They're selling their cakes for $65 a piece. All right. Now let's see, they have sweet potato cupcake, man, woo, I got to try that one. They sell those at $3.50, I guess, per cupcake. What other flavors of cupcakes do they have? I heard they got a Jack Daniels cupcake. I'm trying to find it. Let's see. Anyway, well, I'll have to do that on a separate day. Look at their different different, you know, different flavors of cupcakes that they have. Let me see, cupcake flavors. Let me see what they have here. Okay. And I heard from somebody who's actually been there that their cupcakes are off the chain. They got Mignon's mix of assortment. She's got an assortment batch that you can get from her for $42. Okay, wait a minute. Cupcake minis. All right, she's got cupcake minis for $15. She does birthday cakes as well. All right, study her site. This woman, once again, her family, it's a production society, just her family. Now, she's got some outsiders now, I believe, that working in there. But once again, that's why we went on here to, you know, see how much of her family, you know, got into it or whatever. But in any event, the question today is, what does your family make? Now, in some cases, the family might not make anything, but they sell things. They might be distributors. You know, so if you've got like a Korean grocery store or carryout or convenience store or Arab or whatever, or it can be black, white, it can be anybody, they might not make anything. Like, for instance, I know of a store in the D.C. area, and I'm sure this is all over the place. And I saw a guy set up like this in Barbados. They had, like, general stores, you know, I guess you can call them little neighborhood convenience stores. And the only thing they would make is coffee. Free coffee if you came in. Well, the place in Barbados is free coffee if you're a customer. And he had a little place outside, you know, a little outdoor cafe. You order coffee, you can sit there all day and just drink coffee. Free. All right. But he figured, okay, people come in and they get coffee, but they're going to buy something else. And that strategy typically works. And the coffee house, not the coffee house, the convenience store that I know about in D.C., started out as a 7-Eleven. And the people lost the franchise, so the Koreans came in. And they have coffee. They have coffee. Now, if you buy, I think with them, you got to buy something, and then you can have as much coffee as you want. But typically, there's no place to sit down in that place, so you get the coffee to go. But people are coming and buy donuts, a can of this, orange juice, stamps, cigarettes. They sell beer there, you know, pantyhose, umbrella, all kind of stuff that you might find in a convenience store. And so the one thing they make is coffee. All right, but the rest of the stuff is, you know, they're sourcing it from other people. So in any event, there's some ideas that I put out there. Now, that about wraps it up for me for today. So if you don't have a family business, on and see, here's another thing. You can train your children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, whatever you got. You can train them on how to work within the family business, because when one day you can turn it over to them, but you got to train them first. And instead of your son or daughter going out and getting a paper route, your business, no matter what kind of business it is, well, maybe some businesses you can't, You can have a newspaper for your business. It can be as something as simple as a one-page flyer. And instead of them going to the local newspaper, slinging papers for the local newspaper's business, they can sling flyers for your neighborhood business. You know, go stick this in mailboxes or cars or what have you. So, now, besides the Amish and the Mennonite, and even your church, because like the United House of Prayer for All People, one of their primary revenue sources is selling soul food. And there's not too many places where you find a black-owned and operated soul food place in the United States. Probably somewhere like Sweetie Pies in Missouri. I don't know how they're doing at the moment, but the United House of Prayer for All People, it's to my knowledge. There might be some I don't know about, but they probably are the number one as far as locations that sell, that they have black folk that own the church, that own the establishment, that actually cook the food, and it's soul food. Turkey wings, smothered steak, smothered chicken, fried pork, you name whatever soul food, peach cobbler, the whole nine. Potato salad, coleslaw the way we like it. United House, correct me if I'm wrong, but to my knowledge, I think they, I don't know, there might be 143 of them in the country, but they're the number one black-owned and operated soul food people in the United States. So, but it's not promoted that way. That's a production society. Now, the church, you know, is benefiting from that as it should. I'm just saying that some of these people that are cooking that food in there can start their own thing up. Now that might be the tricky part of the whole thing. Because I know of, and I've shared this story on here before, there was a business right outside of Washington, D.C. called Pops and Son. It was a black-owned business. And most of the time, you know, had a good location. And served good food. But every time you went into Pops, it was very sparse. It would be maybe 2, 3, 4, maybe 6 people at the most in there. Most of the time I went in there, I was the only one. When I stepped in there, I would basically want takeout orders. So if I was in the mood for a pork chop dinner, and with me at the time, I might order 2 or 3 of those. Three to four of those in a year. Because I don't know how to cook pork chops or anything like that. I don't know how to fry them either. So when I was in the mood for a soul food fried pork chop dinner, I'd go to Pops. But that's only, you know, 3 or 4 times a year. So, and I would say half the time when I walked in there, there would be nobody in there but me ordering. Other 2 times, it would be, you know, some people that come in for lunch or whatever. But it was never crowded when I went in. So one day, it was like dusk, quite dark yet, but dusk. I was coming through this is on New Hampshire Avenue, and I guess we would call it Tacoma Park, Maryland. And not too far the district line. So I was at a light, coming up on a light. I wasn't at the light, but coming up on one. and I saw that the parking lot of Pops and Son was packed. I said, what the hell's going over there at Pops? I ain't never seen a full parking lot over there at all. So, now, in my mind now, because I'm looking at the building that I've been in a number of times over the years, the parking lot where I had parked, and I had in my head Pops and Sons. So I pulled on into the, I was going somewhere else, but I said, oh, I got to make a detour. I got to see what's happening with Pops. And I was happy for Pops because, he finally held on long enough to have a full house. So I parked my car, went in there, and see a black folks eating up a storm, ordering stuff. And I had money ready to order. And then I looked at the cash register. And standing behind the cash register was an Asian man. I don't have nothing against Asian men because I ordered something from Asians every month. But I had in my mind that I would see Pops. Pops wasn't there. And then when I realized that wasn't Pops, I realized that the sign outside and the sign within the restaurant wasn't Pops. It was a name change. I can't remember it because I haven't stepped inside that place since. But it had been new ownership, new name change, and they weren't selling soul food. They were selling, other than wings, they were selling Chinese food. And one other lady that was in there, she came in a little bit behind me, and she said, whatever happened to Pops? I left without ordering anything. I didn't sit down, didn't go to the cash register. I just left out disappointed that I can't even finish my sentence. Can't finish it. But I'm sure that place is still in business and doing well. So if any of you soul food cookers out there, and there's plenty of them, you might have to set up. You might have to partner up with an evangelist or a pastor and set up as a church with your primary profit center, not so much being the tithes and offerings, but selling soul food dinners. But selling anything under the auspices of a church. I don't know the inner workings of the United House of Prayer for All People, but, and you know, I don't know their finances, but I know this. It's lunchtime right now. I was talking to a guy in Charlotte, North Carolina, yesterday, and he said their hours of operation for the food is 11 a.m. to 3. So at the 143, the count might be larger than that of the number of United House of Prayers for All People nationwide, but I know this, between the hours of 11 to 3 and their prospective time zones, you know, when they're not taking in tithes and offerings come in Sunday and then Bible study. That might be on Tuesday or Wednesday. Some churches have a Friday night service. Well, people eat every day. So I don't know what kind of cash they take in, but That's how they roll. That's their business model, and it works. It works. All right, so, and the United House of Prayer within that is a production society. From what I understand, they get together and they help build churches, their own church sanctuaries. Now, I don't know if they do it for the larger ones, but from the smaller ones, they've done so in the past. I like to bring somebody on here that's within that community to talk, within that society, excuse me, to talk about that. But the one thing, you know what, I'm going to ask my friend if I can get one of their cooks on, get them on this live stream. Because this is something that can be done within a family. Once again, the psychology, well, Sweetie Pies, everybody knows that's a family-based soul food restaurant. That's a, and they have more than one location. It's a shame about what happened to her son. And hopefully, because the FBI is in on it. I don't know how he's going to get out of that, but if you know the backstory of what happened to her son, but because he's been accused of something, I'm going to say he's innocent until proven guilty, but man, with the gold mine that he had, and he had a vision that Sweetie Pies could be a nationwide soul food chain. And I agree with him 1,000,000,000%. But I don't know, because he's been accused of something. He's been accused of murder. I don't know whether he did it. I don't know if the trial's come up. I haven't heard anything about it in months. And I think Sweetie Pies is still operating. They had probably about maybe 3 locations. He had one of them. And we'll cover that story one day, because allegedly he killed for insurance money on another blood relative. Man, if you got a successful operation like Sweetie Pies, what more do you need? But I don't know the whole backstory, so we're going to cover that on another day. But with Sweetie Pies, what do they make? They make soul food. You know. And a lot of people after church, they like to go out and eat. They got that market. They also got the lunchtime crowd. You know, so positive examples, Sweetie Pies, and then, the largest operation, but this is what I like about the United House of Prayer, all people, is they're in plain sight. Every last one of the sanctuaries that I've seen are all in black neighborhoods. Every last one of them. They're just sitting there quietly in the hood making bank. Totally non-controversial. Quietly selling soul food dinners. So I'm pretty sure that they make more off the top. I'm sure they make more off of selling. You know what? I'm going to say they probably make more off of selling cornbread and let me pick out a dinner here. A soul food dinner. Smothered chicken dinner. I'm sure they make more off of those two items combined than they probably do in tithes and offerings. Just something to think about. All right, well, that's all I got for today. If you guys want to chime in on anything, please do. I see something here from Madam C.J. Walker. I'm going to play this audio about Madam C.J. Walker, because she created a production society that produce hair care products for black women. That's what she did. So I would say a good business model for anything that you might want to deal with, or practically anything, is one of your first steps is form a production society. And that can start up with you and maybe one other person. We'll be back after this.
One in a Million, the history of Madam C.J. Walker and her entrepreneurial legacy. Not even her poor and difficult beginnings stymied Madam Walker's road to greatness. Born December 23, 1867, roughly 2 years after the alleged emancipation of her race, she was an orphan at 7, a wife at 14, a mother at 17, and a widow by 20. The woman who would become known as the first self-made female millionaire and the greatest benefactress of her race was born the daughter of Owen and Minerva Breedlove, poor ex-slaves living on a cotton farm in Louisiana. They named their special little girl Sarah Breedlove. A washerwoman by trade, at the age of 33 in 1900, Sarah began selling a product door-to-door which she had formulated to remedy her own hair loss. She pinpointed the root of her hair problems, which was the scalp, and created hair care products and a beauty regimen for hair growth and maintenance that focused on the need for a clean and healthy scalp, scalp protection, and scalp stimulation for maximum hair growth. Her first product would eventually be called Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, and she boldly and proudly used her own likeness on her jars and her own before and after pictures to demonstrate her product's effectiveness. Per Madam's own words, she abhorred the impression held by some that she claimed to straighten hair. She emphatically stated, "I grow hair," and that there would be no hair-growing business today had I not started it. She described her concept and method of hair growth as beauty culture because she compared growing hair to growing and cultivating garden plants. She then broadened this concept of beauty culture by incorporating the value of cleanliness and professionalism, which emphasized the overall appearance, moral conduct, and character of the black woman. Black women from all over the country began writing letters to Madam Walker attesting to the benefits of her products. By setting up a special correspondence course of beauty culture in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then a manufacturing facility in Indiana, and later a beauty college in New York City, Madam was able to further establish and promulgate her program of beauty culture, which trained the black female in three areas. First, the black woman was taught the proper presentation of herself. She was to be clean, neat, properly attired, and well-mannered. Second, she was taught how to use Madam's hair care system on customers. And third, she was taught how to sell Madam's hair care products to customers. In so doing, Madam C.J. Walker provided a solution to the root of the black woman's demise. She raised the black woman's self-esteem and confidence about her own beauty and intelligence, and she empowered the black woman economically, thus freeing her from white servitude and male dependency. This accomplishment is even more amazing when put in the context of the time in which these things were done and in the context of Madam's own background. The time, one historian called the nadir, or lowest point in the history of the black race outside of slavery itself. The blessings of freedom was now marred by the blatant terrorist acts of the Ku Klux Klan and those like-minded individuals working in collusion with them. The harsh reality faced by the vast majority of blacks living in this era was that the number of lynchings peaked during the early 1900s, as did other backlashes sparked by Reconstruction, such as the burning of black churches and schools and the establishment of Jim Crow laws. During this dark period, most black women were either sharecroppers or washerwomen and house servants for whites. Madam Walker was no exception, but she was, however, exceptional. Madam Walker moved her ever-expanding special correspondence course business, founded on her system of beauty culture, to Indianapolis, Indiana, on February 19, 1910. She then purchased and paid for her home, adjoining which was a factory and laboratory, located at 640 North West Street. She endeared herself to the citizens of Indianapolis when she contributed $1,000 to the establishment of the Senate Avenue YMCA. It is reported that she was the only woman to make such a donation. Madam herself, when referring to the YMCA donation, had this to say, quote, "In referring to that $1,000 gift, I don't want you to lay so much stress on it, and do not say that I am the only one. You might say that I was the first and caused others to awaken to the sense of their duty in helping deserving causes for the benefit of the race," end quote. Not long after her move to Indianapolis, Madam Walker also became a member of Bethel AME Church, one of the oldest and most influential churches in the black community, to which Madam Walker contributed generously. In less than 2 years after moving to Indianapolis, on September 2, 1911, Madam C.J. Walker petitioned the Indiana Secretary of State to become incorporated, and on September 19, 1911, exactly 1 year and 7 months since her arrival in Indianapolis, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company of Indiana Incorporated was established, Madam Walker naming herself president and owner of all 1,000 shares of stock. A relentless worker and ingenious marketer and saleswoman, Madam Walker had thought to place her system of hair care products in black colleges all across the United States. She also regularly advertised in black newspapers, and she eventually placed her products in drugstores. As she traveled throughout the country, she wrote letters to her general manager in order to instruct him on how best to run her factory in her absence and how to implement all of her new ideas. However, the Madam Walker agents, Madam's recruited sales force, were her biggest asset. Madam held public meetings in churches, rented lodge halls and other such facilities, and put on demonstrations, including a slide presentation, in order to recruit black women to become Walker agents. Madam Walker taught and trained them in the methods of application and proper use of her hair oils and vegetable shampoo. Eventually, Madam organized a national convention for her Walker agents, giving away prizes and other incentives to motivate and energize her ever-growing troops of Walker agents. Sales generated from Madam Walker's manufacturing company and the hair care products it produced enabled Madam to give birth to yet another legacy, as Madam became known as the greatest benefactress of her race. Through monies earned and derived from Madam's work in the hair-growing business, Madam Walker regularly donated large sums of money to charity and to individuals of her race who were in need. In fact, Madam was so self-sacrificing and freely giving that those closest to her were worried that she would become financially ruined. Desiring all blacks to have decent homes, at times, Madam would assume mortgages of blacks who were financially strapped, allowing them to repay when and how they could. Various schools for blacks and certain social and civic organizations dedicated to the betterment of the black race were also beneficiaries of Madam's philanthropy. Though many have called Madam extravagant, her generosity and passion for her people were Madam's only extravagances. She gave not for self-aggrandizement, but rather to inspire other wealthy blacks to give likewise. Moreover, Madam's giving went well beyond monetary donations. She lent her name and time to worthy causes. She traversed the country, speaking speaking against lynchings and fought vehemently for the fair treatment of black soldiers who had served in America's military during World War I. Madam C.J. Walker was an ambassador of sorts, a spokesperson for all black-skinned people, a revolutionary, visionary, missionary force. It should therefore be quite obvious that Madam Walker's passing on May 25, 1919, was a tremendous loss to the black race. At that time, Madam had recruited over 25,000 black women from the United States, Central America, and the Caribbean as door-to-door beauty culturists and was well on her way to Africa. Her net worth was over $1 million, making her the first female, regardless of color, to become a self-made millionaire. She is one of the most successful black entrepreneurs of all time and one of the first to utilize the method known today as direct sales marketing to distribute her products. She had also managed to build a 32-room mansion in Irvington, New York called Villa Loaro, which she had desired to be left as a monument to her name and as an example to her race of what hard work and black support of black enterprises could achieve. After Madam's 1919 passing, her hair care manufacturing corporation was used as collateral to secure the finances needed to build what is today known as the Madam Walker Theater Building. Completed in late 1927, the Walker Building Beauty Salon continues to operate there and continues to sell Madam C.J. Walker's original hair care products. Years later, in 1982, the trustees of Madam Walker's trust would deposit a large portion of Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company's business records, historical documents, pictures, and memorabilia with the Indiana Historical Society, who took on the task of painstakingly organizing and preserving the Madam Walker legacy. 74 years after the incorporation of the Madam Walker Company, in 1985, the 1,000 shares of capital stock of Madam's corporation were sold to a man named Raymond L. Randolph, making him the first person since Madam Walker herself to own all 1,000 shares of stock in the original Madam Walker Company. A graduate of Attucks High School, Mr. Randolph had never dreamed that he would become the owner and caretaker of this phenomenal legacy. In honor of Madam C.J. Walker, Mr. Randolph placed Madam Walker's image back on the jars of her original hair care products with the words, "Since 1911," placed underneath it. Doing business today as Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises Incorporated, the hair care company founded by Madam C.J. Walker continues to manufacture and sell her original quality products, ensuring that the legacy of this remarkable woman never dies. The Madam Walker Agent Program has been reinstituted and is the main method by which her products are distributed today. On September 24, 2011, Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises sponsored a centennial celebratory walk called Tracing the Footsteps of a Legacy. This event marked the 100th year since the pivotal point in her entrepreneurial legacy when Madam Walker incorporated her manufacturing company, the Madam C.J. Walker business family, which includes the Madam Walker agents, will continue to keep Madam Walker's spirit alive and well by ensuring that her labor of love, her manufacturing business, continues operating according to the entrepreneurial blueprint she left behind and which is detailed in the historical documents of the company. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah Breedlove. You are indeed one in a million.
right, we've been talking about production societies and family GMP, family gross national product, and the question of the day is, what does your family make? Now, we got a few minutes left on here, and I want to get into some news or anything you guys want to talk about, 619-768-2945. But in the news here, all right, let me see. Here's some of the headlines. Man who hits police with poles on January 6th gets prison. He got 63 months. Okay. That's a heavy sentence. Here's one article here. Female, this is the headline, female inmates raped for hours by male inmates. Well, let's see what this says. Not a terror. Female inmates raped when male detainees bribe guards, lawsuit says. Now, I wonder how they bribe them because they ain't got no cash up in there. Okay, let me see. This article says, female inmates at an Indiana jail were subjected to a night of terror when male detainees gained access to their cells, the woman alleged in the lawsuit. The lawsuit was filed Friday, July 22nd by eight women against Clark County Sheriff Jamon Noel. Or Noel at in current and former Clark County jail officers. It was the second lawsuit filed this summer following the alleged incident, with 20 women filing suit in June, court records show. The women claimed that on October 23, 2021, jail officer David Lowe gave two male detainees keys to the interior of the jail in exchange for $1,000. I'm trying to figure that one out. Because when you go into jail, they search you. And any kind of money that, you know, valuables and all, they put away for safekeeping. And the $1,000 is put on your books, commissary. I'm just trying to piece this together now. All right, now. So that night, the two male detainees and other male inmates went to a restricted area of the jail that housed women, according to the lawsuit. Numerous male detainees used keys obtained from Lowe and entered pods 4E and 4F, where they were raped, assaulted, harassed, threatened, and intimidated by the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. The plaintiffs, all right. And other women for several hours, resulting in significant physical and emotional injuries. The lawsuit filed in the United States District Court of the Southern District of Indiana. The men threatened to further harm the women if they pressed the emergency call button, according to the lawsuit. The women claimed that in the lawsuit that no jail officers came to their aid throughout the night, despite the assaults being viewable on surveillance video. Scotty Maples, chief deputy of the Clark County Sheriff's Department, said that when the first lawsuit was filed, the department would not comment on the pending lawsuits, according to the News Tribune. Sheriff Noel has publicly commented on the lawsuits. The Clark County Jail in Jeffersonville, about 2 miles north of Louisville, Kentucky, days after the alleged incident, Lowe was fired and charged with trafficking with an inmate, aiding escape, and official misconduct. The station said Lowe admitted to accepting the bribe and allowing inmates access to restricted areas in the jail. His criminal, oh boy, this dude is so, there'll be other people going to prison behind this. Man, that's outrageous. And for, $1,000 is nothing. All right, what's another headline here? Let's see. Messy details emerge from divorce gripping WNBA. So what's that about? Liz Cambridge, and if people don't know who she is, she's in the WNBA Women's National Basketball Association. Liz is about 6'8 and 6'9. Lynn Cambridge's Sparks divorce had conflict from jersey number choice to film sessions on-court gripes. Okay, so basically we have a prima donna professional basketball player that's whining about something. Okay. They really have low attendance, so I guess they got a PR person put in anything that, let's see, WNBA grinder tells court of poor translation at her arrest. Well, she can't speak Spanish. I'm not Spanish or Russian. Be a good time to learn, though. Well, here's sort of a trending topic for the last this week. What do you think about the pastor? I hate to say it, the black pastor, who he and his wife were robbed of, some say $400,000, some say $1 million worth of jewelry during a live stream of a church service. Any comments on that? 619-768-2945. I just wonder, why would anyone even think about, you know what you can do with that? I'm not even going to get to the $1 million. You know what you can buy for $400,000? You can buy a Rolls Royce for $400,000. If they're used, you can buy two of them. You can live, well, it depends on where you live now. Can you imagine how many houses that you can buy in Cleveland, Ohio, or Baltimore, Maryland, or Indianapolis, Indiana for $400,000? Or how many round trips you can make to Japan or Shanghai, China? How many round trips can you make? So I'm just wondering, if a person earns it, if you earn it now, all right, do what you want, spend your money any kind of way you want. I'm a big believer in that. If you work for it, it's your money, you do what you want with it. But I'm just wondering what went through his and his wife's mind. Like I said, I'm not even going to go to the $1 million figure. I'm just going to settle for the $400,000. $400,000, you can drive to church in a brand new Rolls Royce for $400,000. So you're getting from home to church. While the Rolls are sitting in the parking lot, you can give a sermon on tithes and offerings and how God has blessed me and how he can bless you too. All right, I get that one. Okay. But you wearing $400,000 worth. How much does a Rolex cost? Before I go to the phone lines here, how much does a Rolex cost? Let me see. 14, your mic is open. I never had a Rolex. No, I don't wear a watch. I'm good with my phone. Whatever my phone says, I'm good. Cost a Rolex watch. I'm trying to add this up. Cost of Rolex. Maybe the Rolex costs $400,000. Maybe it was just that one item. The cost of a Rolex can range anywhere from $6,500 to $75,000. So, all right, let's say he had the top-of-the-line Rolex on for $75,000. Okay, so let's say, let's do the math here now. Let's say he had a Rolex for $75,000 on each one of his arms. So that's $150,000. And his wife did the same, $300,000 just in Rolex watches. He's got one on his right wrist and his left wrist, and his wife has got the same. So that's $300,000 accounted for. And oh, you know what? Let's say he had a $100,000 car. They said they got robbed. They got robbed. This was taken off their body. So now I don't, man. How much? Well, you know, how much does a mink cost? Man, I don't even know what they were wearing. I'm gonna start right there. So let's say they had on four wristwatches between four Rolexes between the four of them. So that's $300,000 right there. So I don't know what pair of shoes. Maybe the pastor had on. What's an expensive shoe? All right, let me see. Stacy Adams, how much do those cost? Stacy Adams shoes. All right, they cost anywhere from $39.99 to $119.99. Well, you know what? Maybe he was wearing a pair of Jordans. That's $200 or $300 right there. So he had on a pair. That's $300, and his wife had on another pair. She had on Jordans sitting in the pulpit. So that's $1,200 between the two of them. So we're still quite a few thousand dollars short. 410, your mic is open. Okay, 410's quiet. All right, well, anyway, we might touch back on this tomorrow as more details come out on the pastor. And his wife robbed. I just want to total now the. And some people say, well, why would he need two? Why would they need two? Man, some people are eccentric. Okay, so I'm considered eccentric, but not to the point of two Rolexes. I can't even see putting one Rolex on my wrist because, like I said, me. If I got a smartphone and the smartphone gives me time, I'm good. You know. So, anyway. All right, well, that wraps it up for all. We went 3 minutes over time. All right. Production societies, we'll cover this more in detail as well as offline. Because with the Madam C.J. Walker thing, Madam C.J. Walker, what she did was with the conventions that they mentioned in that audio piece I played, when she put together those hair conventions, that is a production society. You know, in those conventions, she's got an audience that she can sell to that actually her agents can sell to people. All right. But that's all part of it, too. All right, and it sounds like they're still in business, so I'm going to kind of reach out up there as well and see if we can get somebody from the Madam C.J. Walker company on right on this podcast so you can ask them questions directly. On that note, all right, we're 4 minutes overtime. Everyone have a good rest of the day.